Join the battle to defend science. Get your copy of my book today.
Do you agree that DNA contains genetic information?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you give any example of information arising through a natural process?
DNA.
So you've observed DNA form through a natural process?
Well, our cells copy our DNA naturally, not supernaturally.
So that's dealing with existing genetic information. We're talking about the origin of DNA here. Can you present an example of where you see DNA form from, you know, raw materials in a natural process?
Have they put nucleotides together and have it self-assemble at least into like something like RNA where it's able to replicate? I don't know if they've done that with nucleotides, but we've created autocatalytic systems with other types of molecules. I don't know if they've done it with they have done it with RNA before, now that I think about it. But, so I guess I would say yes. But this thing about information, it's not unique to DNA. I mean, I could just, I typically say, like, the simplest forms of matter, like atoms, have information in them. Because we study that in chemistry. You study the periodic table and you look at how the valence electrons tell you and predict how that element will react with other elements. And so you can, if you really know what you're doing, you can take raw materials and react them together in a way to extract a particular substance out of it, because there's quote unquote information there.
So first, to address the first thing you said, I am unaware of anybody anywhere at any point in time in history producing anything close to a strand of DNA. Okay. And by the way, if a bunch of intelligent scientists did come together and do that, that would just prove it takes intelligence to make DNA.
Doesn't that mean that I could never prove to you that this does work this way or that it can work without intelligent design?
No, of course you could. You could throw on some goggles. No, go throw on some goggles. Go, into the ocean, wait for some lightning, and let's see it. Let's see a natural process put it together. The most you get is an appeal to time, which is not a scientific process. You just say, give it enough time and it'll happen. That's not even how probability works. The greater a time takes for an event to take place, the higher the probability. So, I mean, that doesn't make any sense to begin with.
I don't know what that means.
Are you sure you said that right? I think I might have misheard.
No, you don't understand that. Here, I'll give you an example. Let's say that the chances of something happening is 1 in 100. Okay, if you do it 99 times and you don't get it, what are the chances of the next turn?
1 in 100.
It's still 1 in 100. It remains the same. And so if you can increase time and you're not getting your set events, that actually will increase the dislikelihood of the probability. That's actually how it's calculated, right? So that's the point. Just adding time to the equation doesn't make a failing process work.
That either went over my head or it was nonsense. I'm not smart enough to know either way. But you know what? Funny enough, I have some stuff here about DNA and intelligent design that I have not used yet. So, Mike, you wanna go through it?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So my problem with intelligent design is I think it's just a post hoc justification. I don't think that it has any actual explanatory value, because I think if you assert that the God or the intelligent designer did it, there's no explanation. It's just a declaration. So, okay, here are my questions. Where do I want to start? Okay.
Well, I'd really like to address that first thing.
I mean, the questions are designed to do it, but if you want to, that's fine.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying, think about what you just said. Like, that's not necessarily true. I mean, first, if it was ad hoc, that's not an an argument against the evidence, right? That, I mean, it could be post hoc. I don't even see what that's really trying to get at. But also,
post hoc doesn't say that it's therefore not the answer. We got a really bad.
Well, that's what it seems like you implied.
So if your thing can't explain anything, and by that I mean there's no explanation for how it actually works, and it can't make any future predictions, then I think we have an unjustified belief, is what I'm saying.
Okay. You know what? Maybe on its own, that could be true. I would still be looking for a better explanation, and that's sort of my thing about saying that just to appeal to God has no explanatory power, because in our world, we observe things of similar complexities observed in nature. We know we're designed by humans. So that's a firsthand, scientifically observed way to get information. But that's just appealing to God when we see it in the process of photosynthesis in a leaf, or the DNA molecule, the relationship between, you know, birds and bees and plants and that, like, that's not just appealing to God. That's, again, we have observable examples of information deriving from a mind.
Well, I think what you're doing there is begging the question. But I just want to get to my the points that I have here. So, did God design animals to live in the water?
Yeah, some of them.
Okay. Do you agree that dorsal fins, pectoral fins, and tail flukes are useful traits for animals that live in the water?
I'm not sure what all those are, but I'll go ahead and say yes.
It's like dorsal fins, the one on the back, and the pectoral fins are like, you know, on the sides, and a tail fluke. But anyways, and you think those features are designed?
They could be designed. It could also be the process of evolution, adaptation. That's also possible.
So I think that
not every single thing needs to be designed. I think God invented a process, and that's what evolution is, real evolution. Animals adapt to their environment according to their diet, to their environment. Even their, like in epigenetics, you can see that at least some of the experience of the parent seems to be, goes on, drives on to the offspring. Yep. So yeah, not everything, every little aspect needs to be designed, right? Things can adapt and adjust, and in some cases they aren't beneficial, but.
Yep. Well, that's fine, because we're going to deal with that here in a second. So you agree that that an organism's features are sculpted by genes and how those genes are expressed?
Yes.
And is it your opinion that genetic similarities are caused by a common designer?
The genetic similarities. In one way I want to say yes, one way I want to say no. What exactly do you mean by genetic similarities?
Well, so when people say like the human and the chimpanzee, we know that we are related and evolution's the reason because of the genetic similarities. Typical rebuttal is, no, that's evidence of common design, because it's really the genetics, the genes are the thing that's designed by the designer to do the things that genes do, and so it manifests in these phenotypic similarities as well, but it goes all the way down to the level of the genotype.
Okay, yeah, so that's why I was a little hesitant to answer. So you realize that's a metaphysical answer, right? Because in neither scenario does the data change. Right? We can agree that, genetically speaking, humans do possess a lot of similarities to apes than other animals are similar to each other. That, no one disagrees on that. Yep. Now, how do we explain that? One's going to say, well, I think that could be the product of a common design.
Yes.
Now, that could be the case.
Right? Yep. So it's just which one has the best evidence and which one has the best arguments. Right. So what I'm trying to get at here is who has the best evidence, who has the best arguments. So I have a few more questions along these lines. So
Okay.
But is it your opinion that genetic similarities are caused by a common designer? Or are a reflection of common design?
I'm not sure if I'd say cause. Yeah, something like that. Sure, I'll say yes to that, yeah.
Okay, so this means that the genetic code will objectively reveal to us evidence of common design if common design is a thing, right?
Sure.
Okay, do whales have tail flukes, dorsal fins, and pectoral fins, those things I said earlier?
No, I don't think so. I know they have a tail fin, right? Like a tail, but maybe not the other ones?
No, they do. Whales, dolphins would be maybe a slightly better example, but, well, no, they're both the same. They have a dorsal fin, they have a tail fluke that goes back and forth, and they have the pectoral fins. I zoomed my camera in, but the pectoral fins
are those
are the
like
ones.
Look like the arms?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Okay, so they have those things. And do you agree that sharks also have those things?
Yes.
Okay, now I only have two more things. Sorry, it just takes a little while. Hippopotamuses don't have any of those things. They have no tail fluke, they have no dorsal fin, they have no pectoral fins. So then the question is, if common design's the better explanation, why is it that whales and sharks have the same outward design, but if you compare their DNA, it's nowhere close to as similar as the DNA between whales and hippos?
Okay, restate that for me one more time, please.
Why is it that whales and sharks have the same design? They have those features for them to live in the water. But if you compare their DNA, it's nowhere close to whale and shark DNA is not anywhere close as closely similar as whale and hippo DNA is.
I mean, I would imagine this has something to do with genetics. Obviously, it's just like computer code. Sometimes you can change a whole lot of stuff in the code and it doesn't make that big a difference on the screen. But there are other types of code that which are changed can bring out totally different expressions. So I'm just sure that has something to do with the genetics, that there doesn't have to be some type of one-in-one relationship between the genetics there, which seems like that's what you're suggesting, right, in order for there to be a designer.
Well, if common design was a thing, then we were supposed to find evidence of common design when looking at the genome. But when we look at animals that are said to have been designed and they have these designed features, we find that the signature of their design, which is captured in their genetics, doesn't tell you. We have organisms that have the same design, and they're not even remotely close. They're not closely related at all. And two animals that are wildly different, I mean, they have some similarities, like they're both mammals, for example, they're the ones with the similar genetic makeup. But that genetic makeup is supposed to be the evidence of design, and I think it fails here.
So in your worldview, is there like, I'm not entirely sure, are hippos and whales, are they like a part of, you know, connected a certain tree? Are they close to the same common ancestor? What's that explained in your worldview?
Yeah, they're the closest living relatives of each other. And then you could take a look at the fossil record to try to back that up. But we don't even really need to look at the fossil record for this. So if the designer designed the DNA, and DNA informs us of the features and structures that organisms have, and organisms are said to be designed to exist in their environment, God designed them to have whatever these features are, then the problem is when we go off of that, we were supposed to find evidence of design in the genetics, and we don't.
Okay, so in my mind, what you've done is set up a straw man, which is you're basically saying that if the genetics of them both were designed, we should be able to see, based on how they look or appear similar, but yet they're also very different, then genetically, that's not good evidence of them being a common designer. Now, listen, the argument for genetic information is presuppositional, Peterson. To me, that makes no difference at all. They could both be designed and have very different genetics, and in some way may even be related. None of that's a problem in my worldview, Peterson. The question would be, how do you explain the new genetic information needed for one or the other? So which came first, the hippo or the whale?
Well, neither one of them came first. They have a common ancestor.
Did they emerge at the same time?
No. I mean, there may have been some parallel evolution, not parallel's not the right word, but they may have come about on the planet in roughly the same time, but in different places. So they may have each evolved into what they are today roughly at the same time, but hippos didn't come from whales and whales didn't come from hippos.
Yeah, no, I understand. That's the same thing many creationists get wrong when they say that humans and apes, one evolved from the other, right? No, they just have a common ancestor. I understand what you're saying. Okay, now, listen, whatever their common ancestor was, that then became into the whale and the hippo. That is not the product of Darwinian evolution, which through natural selection, which we both agree is real, is merely turning existing genes on and off through their diet, through their environment. Again, no. Even according to epigenetics, there's even some experience. Okay, yes, that is an absolute fact. The genetic differences between them...
genes get duplicated.
...presuppositionally assumed as better explained. You're still dealing with existing genes, and then what existed was just duplicated. The problem,
yeah, no problem
is that,
with that
natural selection cannot produce new genetic information. Again, I'm going
to
say that again. Natural selection cannot produce new genetic information.
But it can select for it.
Your only mechanism, if you were working on an assembly line building planes and you had to select the good ones and reject the bad ones, how long would you have to select till you turn the plane into a car? Right. That's not how a selection process works. Your analogy assumes that natural selection can create something new, and it can't.
But you're saying the quality control element is part of the manufacturing element, and it's not. We know genes get duplicated, and whether or not that's beneficial, adaptive, or whatever, goes through the filter of natural selection. It's like, for example, when you look at arthropods, you know, some have three pairs of legs, some have five, some have more than that. We've looked and we have found that, yes, the difference between the ones with fewer leg segments is duplicated. Are those genes duplicated multiple times? And it doesn't just merely produce more legs. Like for crustaceans, for example, the front legs are very different. They're adapted for sexual selection or hunting or just display. Well, that would be sexual selection, I guess. Or for grooming or put together.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I'll ask you guys, right? This isn't really my debate, but are you not just referring to mutations then, Mike? Would a mutation not be the popping up of new genetic information? Because it's permanently altered.
That's actually the better answer that Peterson did not give. It actually would, in fact, be mutations. And from here, the problem would just be different. Peterson, would you like to argue for mutations or stick with natural selection?
You have to have both because a duplication is a type of mutation, but a duplicated gene can be mutated to have a different purpose, or a pre-existing gene can be mutated to have a different purpose as well. But you have to have not for every single imaginable trait, but they both happen. So I was arguing for mutations, but arguing for mutations isn't arguing against natural selection.
I'm not saying that they aren't. I'm saying that both of these are an argument for your position. They come at you differently. So first off, a mutation is never considered natural selection.
I know.
So you kind of acted like natural selection is a mutation. They're not. They are different. Okay. So that's why there's a separation.
Well, you asked where does new genetic information come from, and that's the answer. Just because natural selection doesn't cause new information doesn't mean that there's a problem.
Okay. If natural selection selects, and what it selects is only from existing genetic information, you have a problem trying to explain how in the world of plants and animals, we can see clear giant leaps in new genetic information. This is like not the difference between a hippo and a whale or a dog between many different types of dogs. We're talking about like animals that don't even have a nervous system and now they do. Okay, these code from nucleotides based on virtually hundreds of thousands of combinations of these amino acids. Okay, so natural selection is not a creative process. That's number one.
That's
number
not a problem.
Two, mutations, in fact, could be.
Okay,
it is a problem. Number two, mutations actually could be an answer to this question because mutations can shuffle genetic information. They can rearrange and do very odd things. So actually, that's possible. You could say through a mutation, the perfect combination of amino acids that produce new metabolic functions came into being. All right, now the problem with this answer is that we can map out the mathematical probabilities of this thing taking place. So if we were going to take 9 letters in the English language, there's something like, you know, 7 to the 10th power of possible arrangements that make up gibberish, right? It's only a fraction that actually form words and then can form a sentence and mean something. So the same is the case of the DNA molecule. You cannot just combine those amino acids in any shape, pattern, or way to get a beneficial mutation. And we know that most mutations result in things which are not beneficial. Like when you get a 5-legged animal, or they're extra short and small, or a 2-headed turtle. There's a bunch of experiments they did on flies where they got all sorts of weird stuff with flies. So mathematically, it's so small. The search space for all the different possible combinations is so vast that, yeah, even with 4 billion years, it's extremely unlikely. Yep.
I don't see why it's unlikely. Like for your language analogy, for example, 10 years ago, skibbity would have been random gibberish and nonsense. But for whatever reason, people started saying skibbity last year, and it actually means something. Why? Because different elements of the language changed as well. Perhaps that gave context for it to start making sense. Or because people are just like, yep, it just now makes sense for whatever reason. So
here's the thing. The reason why that doesn't work is because the word skibbity was applied meaning. That's not the same as something inherent in a code, like Morse code. Morse code has rules for dots and dashes and what they mean. You can't just prescribe meaning upon it. Same thing is true in genetics. Only certain combinations work, and a combination that doesn't work will not suddenly work in the future because you ascribed meaning to it, like the word skibbity.
But Mike, you're limiting your sample size. You gave the analogy of 9 letters. Okay, that's fine. Let's say 9, you know, different species of animals appeared, and they're, you know, you're saying that, okay, there's not enough time and not enough mutations to occur in the amount of time that, you know, we claim the Earth has been around, or, you know, life has been around, for us to get all the variation we have. But that's but if you limit the sample size, of course you're not going to have that. Now, instead of those 9 letters, take, I don't know, the alphabet 550 million times, and you could write out whatever you wanted if you just keep spamming the keyboard. I mean, we've all heard of the monkeys, you know, typing on the keyboard. Given enough time, it will give you Shakespeare's works.
I mean, we just
I hear you. So here's
we know for a fact that we have experimentally verified that mutations do produce, we can call it new information or whatever, that is beneficial for the existence of the organism. So like, I get, and actually natural selection increases the odds of that happening, because when you remove natural selection, when you do forced inbreeding experiments, like I talk about in detail in the book Rational Answers to Stupid Questions on page, I don't remember what page it is. You can see that the mutation.
You wrote a book, man?
Yeah, I wrote a book. This is it. This is the thing I'm talking about right here with stabilizing selection.
Cool.
We can see cool, that man. Those.
Yeah, no, that's not easy. Congratulations. I didn't know you published.
Oh, thanks, dude. We can see that those mutations actually are beneficial when natural selection is able to run its course. And when you remove natural selection, then what's weird is you get more organisms that don't fit as well into the environment and more organisms that fit even better into their environment because the bell curve flattens out. Less people exactly in the middle,
on
the outliers.
So I think both of you are unfortunately, you're making a fallacy. I'll tell you which one that is. But first, Globan. So I want to point out, I'm not entirely sure what you mean by a small sample size. Dude, I am on a walk right now through the woods. I got no resources in front of me. I'm going off my head here. Okay.
No, you're good. I get it.
So in my mind, when I'm saying if you take like a modest protein of like 6 amino acids long, I'm not trying to limit the sample size. I'm just trying to make it easier to understand, right? And if we can do the math on something that small and show the probability of randomly shuffling genes until you get that is so astronomically small, right? Again, that's to communicate a concept. I think that if you increase time, increase even more amino acids, I think the problem only gets worse. So maybe I didn't misunderstand you, but I just wanted to point that out. Now, listen, the fallacy I think both of you are making here is what's called a fallacy of vending machine. You're basically saying, like your example with the monkey and the typewriter, give it enough time and eventually it will take place. This is akin to a vending machine, which let's say it has 100 gumballs. All of them are pink except for one. And you just say, dude, spin the knob enough times and eventually the orange gumball is going to come out. But this is not how probability works. As we gave the example earlier, if your chances of something happening is 1 in 100, your 99th try, the probability remains the same. So you can't just add time and say eventually it'll happen. This is fundamentally a fallacy of vending machine. And the longer time you add in probability, again, only increases its dislikelihood.
Okay, so the problem here is what you're doing this argument very one-dimensionally where you're saying this amino acid works in this combination and there's an uncountable number of permutations of that amino acid that don't work, but those things typically never take into effect. What they're only saying is the different permutations don't allow that amino or that protein to have the same function. But what about different functions? That's pretty much always glossed over. But another thing that makes us really one-dimensional, and I want to go back to the questions on design after this because I don't have a lot of time, but the other thing that makes us really one-dimensional is genes interact with other genes. So what are the odds that one gene being slightly changed makes it work in that gene environment or whatever? Let's just say it's low. But all genes are experiencing subtle changes and variations in their form. And what you're doing there is you're shuffling all the genes, the dice, whatever. I'm not good with statistical biometrics or anything like that. But when all of the genes are experiencing this, then what you're doing is you're basically running huge numbers of these, we can call them simulations almost, vast numbers of trials all at the same time. And now finding combinations that work together is actually not just exponentially more likely, but exponentially more likely.
I was going to say more or less the same thing.
Right.
Again, I really think you're making the same problem. You're viewing these two things like they're alike when they're not. Again, I think my example of the vending machine is a perfect example. And honestly, from my perspective, introducing more variables only complicates it. I don't think that makes it inevitable, which is what you're definitely implying. Okay. However, let's say you're right.
It increases the odds that some combination will be effective or will work. It definitely does that.
We don't deny that.
Okay.
Well, listen, that's a changing of the argument. The argument is not whether it's possible that a mutation could in fact create a beneficial mutation. I already agree that is possible. The question is, what is the probability? What are the chances? Okay. And they're so astronomically small, it actually is better to say they were designed this way intentionally. Okay,
yeah.
Now,
so,
again, let's say you're right, though. Let's go ahead and say you're right. All right, so this is how it happened. The biggest problem with this position is that you cannot observe it still taking place today. There is no example that can be given where it has been observed that of amino acids forming naturally and then grouping themselves into the nucleotides, which then create, really, that's just one part of the cell. It doesn't even explain how you got the outer cell. Like, how did it develop itself without any code? It presupposes something nonsensical.
I don't need to presuppose abiogenesis in order to prove that Darwinian evolution is true. I don't need to do it. Life could have been miraculously created billions of years ago, and everything we know about evolution would still be true.
I'm trying to internally critique here. Let's say you're right. Let's say it happened this way. Because it cannot be observed taking place today, you're still appealing to mystery in the same way that you get on creationists for saying God did it. It's virtually the same, except in our scenario, we have a creative force, which is a mind, some type of intelligence. The guy earlier said he doesn't like to call it God. I get it, but that's what it would be, okay?
So again, I think the problem is I actually do have causal explanations for this, like mutations and like duplications of genetic material and mutations of that genetic material, which
we just dealt with that, Peterson.
Yes, I know, but I don't think you defeated it in any way. And I want to go back to the other thing because I said this is what I want to do. And by other thing,
definitely
I mean the first thing. You have your designer, okay. But I don't think it's an explanation. It's just a placeholder that has there's no explanation for how it works or why certain things end up the way they do versus why are they this way versus another way. So I just want to quickly go over some examples because I might leave here kind of soon and you might lose your Starlink DNA or internet out there in the forest too. So for example, these are questions that I don't think have answers, and I think that's the problem for the God hypothesis. Why did God design animals that live full-time in the water to breathe air when other marine animals don't?
Ooh, great question. I love that. I'm not sure. Maybe it's so that they could be on land, a little bit more, so we could see them more. I mean, who knows? I'd just be speculating. Good. That's a good question. I could ask you 100 of those about evolution. Oh, yeah.
Well, so like dolphins, they can't spend any time on land. So why did God create animals that can only live in the water that breathe air when other marine animals don't?
I mean, probably for the same reason that humans build cars that drive on land and some that drive in the water and others that go completely under called submarines and, for different purposes relating to, I think, one, proclaiming his intelligence and glory, but maybe it's just because it's freaking cool. Maybe that, like we get to see all these different cool, different types of animals. And I mean, I'm sure you feel the same way I do, right? When you look at nature, this stuff is incredible. This is amazing what it does, how it makes you feel. There could be a dozen explanations, both scientifically and philosophically, for why there are animals that live in the water, but can breathe air. Okay.
Sure. I don't want to get too much into it because I want to ask you some more questions, but from our worldview, the what Darwin called evolution was descent with modification. So you can't start over. Like if I was going to build a cars, like their engines famously, you know, they have to suck in air because the way an ice engine, an internal combustion engine works is suck, bang, squeeze, blow, right? Well, if I was going to design a submarine, I obviously wouldn't design a submarine that has to have a snorkel that goes up into the air to suck in air. It would just be designed to only work in the water without that necessity. And to me, it doesn't make any the evolutionary explanation for why we have air-breathing animals in the water makes way more sense than the idea that they were designed to live there full-time but do something that animals that live on land and in the air do. Next one is, can you think of a good reason to put wings in the trunk of a car?
Reason to put wings in the trunk of a car? I mean, I think I want to say no, Peterson.
No, neither can I. But we know that there are species of ground beetles where they're, it's called an elytra. I just learned this word. It's their wing cover. Their wing cover is actually fused, but they still do have wings under that wing cover. You know, like when a beetle, it cracks open that wing cover or whatever. Why on earth would God design ground beetles with wings inside of a wing cover that can't even open?
I don't know, man. You should put your faith in Yeshua so that when you die, you can be resurrected and live in a world with God forever. Maybe you could ask him one day.
It's not an answer. Evolutionarily, we have no, an answer for that. They're
dude,
niche.
I don't know. I don't know why.
Yeah, I know. That's the problem. Cool, yeah, I know. That's awesome. That's the problem. Like the God hypothesis.
You think it's a bad design based on what? Your finite human brain? You want to look at beetles and be like, why do you put the wings in the back? Like, dude, please, you're dealing with a mind, if it exists, that's transcendently far smarter than your own.
We add
wings. You think of yourself far too highly if you think your beetle question is a dunk.
But Mike, why would he
have
wings?
No, the problem is there is an evolutionary explanation. Ostriches can't fly, but that's kind of what birds are known for, right? But they still have wings. So there are trade-offs in evolution. If an organism begins occupying a slightly different niche, then there isn't selective pressure on whatever organ or body part you have there. And so there's no need for it to be used in the way it was. And so they can, for example, conserve energy by not growing such, in this case, big wings, or for the beetle, the ability... I mean, even if its wing cover could open and the wings didn't work, it would still be a little bit of a problem. It's just kind of a quirk that their wing cover can't open, but it doesn't affect their survivability in any way. Do you want to do a couple more or not?
Okay, so wait. Let me say one thing about this. So again, Peterson, I'm not an evolution denier. I believe evolution is real. It's within the living organisms. Natural selection is real. Animals can adapt, including their wing sizes. This is what Darwin showed with the beaks on the, you know, with the finches and their beaks, that some were harder, some were longer and stretched out. It had to do with what they were eating and where they were on the island. Like, these things can happen. There can be changes, and maybe one is less beneficial given to a different environment. Like, none of that is a problem. The problem would be, how do you get the genetic information? Yeah, that's real. No one denies that. The problem is that from different family types of animals, there are huge differences in the genetic information.
You
cannot explain
we went over that.
New genetic information with natural selection. Yeah. You should understand.
Hold on. Everybody's got time out.
The difference in the size of a beetle wing.
Gotcha.
We have a really bad lag. That's
you
why.
You cut me off first. Right.
I know. But there's such a lag
it
decays pretty rapidly. So I think we already went over that because we said, okay, if the signature of the design is in the DNA and there are all these such wildly different organisms, well, let's look at the sharks and the dolphins. They're the more similar organism, and we don't see the evidence of their design when we look in the genetics, because there's a way to predict common design in the genes, and it just simply doesn't bear out when you yes. compare the shark and the dolphin DNA versus the hippopotamus and the whale DNA.
Yep, and yep, you in fact said this, and I told you that that is a straw man. Okay, I mean, actually, what we could also mention is that some things are similar, but that's not even the argument, Peterson. The argument, I told you, small lines of code can change big things and small things. It just depends on which line of code you're changing, all right? So that's not an argument that these things could not have a common designer. That would not follow from that argument.
But and again, the
greater question was how you got the genetic information to begin with, Peterson.
The problem is the evidence that would have confirmed the common design thing by looking at the organism and comparing their genes wasn't found. It's like, for example, like with evolution,
only if your straw man is true. That's not my argument.
No, because
there
was nothing.
Who makes this argument to you, Peterson?
You agreed with every premise. So if it's a straw man, then your problem isn't with me because I just asked the questions. And you agreed, but it didn't. The evidence wasn't there in the end. So I want to do at least one more here. Do birds have teeth?
All right. I think there's some, right?
No.
Some type of teeth? Yeah.
No.
No, I'm pretty sure there are. Haven't we dug up certain birds in the fossil record which showed teeth?
Ah, yes. Okay, well, now you ruined it, so I have to give the whole explanation here. So, I think the evolutionary explanation for this is quite good. I think the tell me why the designer did it this way is literally going to leave us with nothing. I'll just go through the whole thing. Do birds have teeth? Yes. If birds evolved, they would have evolved from an animal that had teeth, and they would have gradually lost teeth. Archaeopteryx, now you can say Archaeopteryx was or was not a bird, it doesn't really matter. Some people say yes, some people say no. We know that Hesperornis for certain was a bird because it actually has a beak, unlike Archaeopteryx, which doesn't have a beak, and there's a few other things. Hesperornis has teeth. So what's the explanation for how this is evidence of anything other than evolution?
Okay, so number one, I don't know the genetic differences for what it takes to produce teeth and not produce teeth. If it is like not that big of a deal, dude, we already agree. Evolution could in fact be the product of this. God doesn't have to design everything. He designed living organisms, which contain within their mating and bearing offspring, things can change. It's called adaptation. If making some teeth it could be within that equation, that could be the answer, okay? Now, if they are the result of large genetic differences, well, then I think you actually have way more trouble answering that because you have to invent some new process by which you can get new genetic information. Natural selection can't do that. So again, I can explain that, be perfectly fine. Fossils are not a problem for creationists. And I think you, on the other hand, have a way harder time doing that.
So is it your position that God created birds with beaks and no teeth, birds with beaks and teeth, and birds that don't even have beaks, like Archaeopteryx, and they do have teeth, all at the same time, and for whatever reason, all of the birds with teeth are now extinct, and we somehow only have birds with beaks and no teeth left?
Okay, so I told you it could be two possible answers. The first could be that, God designed the bird with a capability to adapt to having teeth and not having teeth. There could be a period in time when it's beneficial to have the teeth and a time when it is not. Okay, that could be a possible answer, and God could have done that. There's no problem with this. I believe in evolution. Number two, if it was designed by God, okay, in some intentional way for birds not to have teeth, well, then maybe it wasn't a bird, but you already sort of discredited that and said that it doesn't matter. So it could be a few possible answers.
Okay, so we don't have an explanation for what happened or how it happened or whatever. We just have, well,
yes, we do. It's called evolution. We both believe in it.
Well, no, because you said it could be that God did it this way. Whereas our explanation would very clearly be that birds evolved from different animals that would have, for like, as one example, would have had teeth.
Peterson, and that's what the fossil record shows us. Seriously, dude, I take you. No, you need to understand. Like, I take you very seriously, man. The reason why I'm answering this way is because I told you I don't know the genetic differences between making teeth and not making teeth. That's right. I'm answering on both sides because I feel like it could be either, and I would have no problem with that. So I'm.
This has nothing to do with genetics.
I'm not trying to evade anything. I'm answering because, like, I don't. Again, I have no resources in front of me. I think it could be both. That's honestly how I feel because I don't want to give you a bad answer. Okay. So it could be both.
I mean, it could be, but which one actually has evidence? Because the way birds evolved was predicted. And then we found fossils that correlate with that. Whereas the God thing, there was no prediction of different kinds of birds ever having existed at any point. We're just saying it's possible. Literally anything is possible, but it comes down to what has the better explanation. And this the God explanation for the birds is just literally a post hoc slapping on. Maybe that's just how God did it. There's nothing there.
Okay. So again, maybe you got me on that because I don't know the genetics of what it takes to make teeth or not teeth. But what I will say is I am aware of the genetics of the difference between scales and feathers. And you believe that modern birds are evolved from dinosaurs. Okay. So you would have again to explain how the new genetic information, which does not exist in dinosaurs, somehow now exists in birds, which evolved from them. There's numerous problems we could point out. That would be one.
Hey, I actually have to go. I had one point, if I could, just before I dip out, because I got to make a bit of a drive. This was just talking about the gumball machine analogy that you made, right? So here, I'll just pull it up on the screen. I'm not sure if you can see it, but it'll help the people watching for a visual. So obviously not a beautiful gumball machine, right? It's MS Paint. I'm sorry. But we have all these different color gumballs, and you mentioned pink, so we'll just use pink, right? Let's say that we're shooting for this pink one. This is going to be our quote-unquote, our beneficial mutation, right? All these other ones will be random. Like, we'll even go with what you said, right? Let's assume that all these other ones are going to be non-beneficial mutations. You were assuming, at least from it sounded like, that this is a linear process. One gumball drops out at a time. We see what happens. The issue I had with that analogy, and this is why I brought up sample size, you are limiting yourself to one gumball machine and one string of mutations occurring. Take this, and let's, throw out a random number, 500 million. If we have 500 million of these, and all of these gumballs inside of it are arranged differently, however many times you use it, eventually you're going to get this pink one, but it's going to be different for each and every gumball machine, right? I'm trying to remember back to that.
No, it's okay. You're doing great. I love your diagrams, man. You always do that. You come up with a lot of physical drawings.
Yeah. So life,
no judgment. I like linear, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. These are simultaneous things happening. They're happening alongside each other.
Yeah.
You have many cells in the organism, and you also have many organisms in the population all going through these possible changes. So it dramatically increases the odds of something favorable coming out.
I'll keep listening, but I do got to dip out. Thanks. Thanks for letting me up. Thanks for talking.
Okay. Yeah. Good talking.
Have a good one.
Tyler, see you. I just wanted to point out that I didn't like the vending machine, right? I believe it's a fallacy, right? No, it doesn't work linear like that way. So I actually agree with that premise. I thought that you guys were actually doing this when you say that we'll give it enough time and mutations can make it happen. And I said, and I agree, that's possible, but the likelihood is so small. Again, I think it's just better to say it was designed on purpose.
Sure. Do you want to do one more question?
Yeah, let's hear it.
Why did God give us a genome that contains the gene for making vitamin C, but it doesn't work?
Well, first off, I'm unaware of that. So you're saying that humans possess a gene which can make vitamin C, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, pretty much. I think all primates are in the same boat.
I guess it could be that due to adaptation through natural selection, which again, we both agree is real, that those existing genes got turned off. And so now we can't make our own vitamin C. That could be a process of adaptation. If it's not a process of adaptation, maybe it's because he knew that we would get vitamin C in most of the things we eat, which at that time, at least the older we go back, is not, you know, all our highly garbage processed foods. Maybe that could be it.
I'm pretty sure according to your worldview, humans didn't evolve. So if this happened through the evolutionary process, then that would necessitate that the earliest humans, Adam and Eve, and maybe their kids or who knows, could make vitamin C.
I see how you're viewing that. So listen, how I see this is that we look out into the animal kingdom and what we see are a lot of base kinds. And each of those kinds can reproduce and have many different types and ways, forming big and small, with hair, without hair, lots of different changes using natural selection and existing genetic information. However, when we start comparing family kinds to other kinds, what we find is large differences in genetic information. Not always, but we do find this.
And so, Mick, the question I just want to know about vitamin C
is how, through natural selection, can you explain the new genetic information? We can explain all the different varieties through natural selection. I don't think you can explain the different family types using natural selection.
Okay, so
comment section is just terrible.
every single example I gave today,
terrible. These guys are crying in the comment section.
Every single question I posed led to I don't know, or you can't explain it either. So this is why I said at the very beginning what I said is the hypothesis that God is responsible for all of this has no explanatory value, and I think we've done nothing but confirm that.
How could you say that, Peterson? I've said
you didn't give any answers
over again that these could be let me finish that these could be due to the same mechanism that you believe in. We both believe these could be the product of natural selection. Okay, the question is, does that mean there's no God? Could that not have been designed? And that's why it always goes into the larger differences in family types, right? And why it ultimately gets to origins, right? And a biogenesis. So it's not merely that, like, I'm just going to appeal to evolution when it fits me. No, it's real. It's totally real. I think you are appealing to what it cannot do, though. There's no evidence that natural selection mutations can produce new genetic information, okay? That's okay. Again, what, so don't come back at me and say, well, it appears like it.
Yeah. So
I'm sorry. Cutting you off.
Do you have any kind of way to give me a ballpark number of when God created all of the life on Earth, what percentage of the life we see today was present at that first creation?
I mean, I would assume most of it. I think from the fossil record, we can see not everything has survived, and some things that have survived are highly depleted or endangered. But probably most things. I mean, we can find everything from dragonflies to turtles to crustaceans in every layer of the fossil record. So that could just be one evidence for that off the cuff.
So the reason I brought that up is because you said, well, we both believe that there's a type that natural selection does happen. You just think it can't do some things And so we have to invoke God for those other things.
Correct.
And so in order to, if we're going to
I didn't even say anything yet.
So in order to figure out, okay,
because like in one way that's fair, but then you're totally not fair. You know, it's just, it's hard.
No, I think I'm fair because if that's the case, then we have to weed out what, if we agree on certain things and we have to figure out what kinds of things their explanation is precluded from you versus me. Now you say the idea that entire,
right.
Like you say the idea that billions of years ago, there's only unicellular organisms. And today we have more than that is not tenable. Or like even only 200 million years ago, there were no mammals and today there are. You think that idea is equally untenable. So my questions have been designed, I think, only to, they've been carefully crafted to get at if the things in your worldview that you think preclude my worldview are the case, then this is what we should be able to find, or I need some kind of explanation for this. The vitamin C thing for humans and all other primates, we eat a lot of citrus fruit. And so if the gene for making vitamin C mutated to the point where it doesn't work anymore, that doesn't matter because it's supplemented in our diet. Whereas, why did God make us with a genome where vitamin C doesn't work? There is no explanation for that, I don't think, because you'd have to, if Adam and Eve had it and then later it went away after sin entered the world, okay, what evidence do we have that Adam and Eve could make vitamin C? And what's the explanation for how it became dysfunctional after sin? This is just nothing, this will be nothing but slapping the God label on stuff post hoc. And so from the very beginning, that was kind of what I was trying to get at with all of these. But anyways.
Right. What we're here, well, the only thing that I'll say is that I think your first half of how you describe my position is totally correct. I think evolution is real. Natural selection is real. There are just some things it can't do. In this case would be the new genetic information we see between large family types of animals. Now, that said, I do think that there are issues with the idea that these evolved into each other over millions of years, including when you talked about single-cell organisms. I don't think you can even present a good explanation for the existence of multicellular organisms from single-celled life. That's actually a great, great example.
Now, listen, even still,
let's say your position is correct. Listen, the only other thing I want to say is that I am not going to deny that when I'm pointing out, look at these huge genetic differences, natural selection can't do this, that I am and then appealing to God. I want to fully acknowledge that with you. Now, that said, the reason why I felt like you weren't being like totally fair is because you say it in a way as though I'm just appealing to mystery, when in fact, I'm appealing based on a known data set. These are vast amounts of microscopic genetic information bits. Okay, where did they come from? We could conclude that it came from a mind who designed it, right? So to me, that's not like implausible. That's not unreasonable. I think that totally follows from the data. Now, which God that would be is a totally different question. But that's really the last thing I wanted to say.
Yeah, or it could be unicorn queef dust because it has magical properties.